From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has released a bracing report. It finds that humans only have about the next decade to slow down the current level of greenhouse gas emissions before there's a tipping point and parts of the Earth are irreversibly changed. Scientists meeting in South Korea over the past weekend have reached a consensus that it's possible to limit a rise in global temperatures, but that will require monumental changes in policy. Brenda Eckwurzel is Director of Climate Science for the Union of Concerned Scientists. Brenda, what is your reaction to this very dire prediction in the report?
You captured it. This is a really important report, and the assignment to the scientists was to tell us what is the difference between the world warming 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels? And the difference is, as you said, striking and dire in many instances.
So this is a lot of scary predictions, but a lot of scary predictions are made in a lot of climate studies by different sources. What makes this one different, and how do you gauge the importance of these predictions?
A lot of the scientists study talk about much larger changes by 2100, 3 degrees Celsius, which, by the way, happens to be what countries have put forth in their nationally determined contributions to try to help solve this. So they look at much higher temperatures. This is the first report to really look at what would it be like at 1.5 degrees C and how much effort would the world have to take to reach that goal.
So again, 1.5 degrees Celsius doesn't sound like a lot. What would be the consequences according to this?
Well, it is a big deal because think about this. The world has gone through about 0.8 degrees Celsius rise since the pre-industrial period. If we added another 0.6 degrees Celsius to get to 1.5 degrees, just think about how many in extreme heat waves the world has already experienced at the level of climate change we already have. The amount of hurricane extreme precipitation. What we know is that coral reefs are one of the very vulnerable species of ecosystems that are at risk at 1.5 degrees C. And at 2 degrees C, the report says we could likely lose vast majority of our coral reefs.
And on the positive side, I mean, this takes a look at the negative as well, but it says if the world was able to change and if it was able to get a hold of the climate change and global warming going on right now, half as many people would suffer from a lack of water. There would be fewer deaths and illnesses from heat and smog and infectious diseases. Seas would rise about 4 inches less, and there would be substantially fewer heat waves and downpours and droughts. One author says this is a monumental task to reverse our current course, but it is not impossible. What do you say?
The good news, it is not impossible, and that 4 inches of extra sea level rise between a 1.5C world and a 2C world is worth fighting for because that's the difference in exposing an additional 10 million people around the world to risk from sea level rise. So it's really worth doing this. And the good news is we haven't reached 1.5C yet. It will require, as you said, many transformational changes in our energy infrastructure, the way we travel, the way we grow and consume food. And it won't be easy. However, there are signs of hope. The governor of California has recently, just a couple weeks ago, signed into law 100% clean energy and trying to get to net zero carbon emissions by the year 2045. And that is something that's really important to realize, that people are stepping up and leaders are stepping up to make sure that we try to stay on track with the Paris Climate Agreement.
Our federal leaders stepping up, though, because what you're talking about that Governor Jerry Brown has done, many of these things run headlong into what the Trump administration has put forth in rolling back Obama-era climate measures. The administration in Washington is not the only one that is rolling back some environmental controls. It's happening in many countries. So the will might be there on the parts of some people. Can anything be done if the political will is not there?
Well, it's interesting because of that clean power plan that sent a signal. by the Environmental Protection Agency to reduce emissions in the electricity sector. And what that has unleashed is ripple effects that, such as the U.S. Climate Alliance, which now includes 17 U.S. states representing about 40% of the U.S. population, that are committed to achieving the federal Clean Power Plan and, in fact, exceeding the targets of the Clean Federal Plan, because many of the states understand that with a pullback at the federal leadership level, we need to have individuals and states and communities such as cities stepping up.
Brenda, thank you.
Thank you.
Brenda Eckwurzel is Director of Climate Science for the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington. China has detained and is investigating the former president of Interpol, Meng Hongwei, for bribery. Meng disappeared in late September after he traveled to China from Lyon, France, where Interpol is headquartered. Michael Bristow reports for the BBC, and Michael, Meng Hongwei disappeared late last month after he sent a cryptic text to his wife. What was in that text?
Well, there were two texts, actually, and this was on the 25th of September. The first one said, in Chinese, wait for my telephone call. A few minutes later, he then sent an emoji of what appeared to be a dagger, suggesting, oh, this is certainly how his wife saw it, that he was in danger. We heard nothing until late on Sunday evening. The National Supervisory Committee, this is a new organisation which investigates corruption, said they were holding him. And then on Monday, the Ministry of Public Security said they were holding him on suspicion of bribery.
So these are official Chinese departments that are holding him, but they waited a long time before they even made that announcement. What's their reason for waiting, and what's their reason for holding him?
Well, firstly, they haven't said what their reason for waiting is, and that's usual in China. They don't feel as though they have to explain things as they might do in a Western country where there's a more formal legal process which has to be observed.
But even for a major international figure like this, the head of Interpol?
Well, even for a major figure like this, the head of Interpol, he was the president. He also was still a vice minister at the Ministry of Public Security. He still is a Chinese national. Your question is an interesting one, because you would imagine that it would be difficult for the head of the world's most important international policing agency simply to go missing. But that gives you an indication of the nature of the country that China is. They feel that they can detain him. The law says that they can detain him, and detain him they did.
And on what grounds?
Well, on suspicion of taking bribes, but as in the United States and Western Europe, you might have to explain exactly what ground you had for detaining somebody. Certainly in Britain, you would have to go before a judge and explain why you wanted to keep somebody in custody. You'd have to go through the evidence you had against him. None of that applies in China. The law says they can be held for a particularly long time, and then people are held outside the legal framework anyway. People sometimes just disappear to reappear several months later, or even after a longer period of time, admitting they were guilty of something, or a court case having been gone through. But anybody living in the West who used to our procedures, then it seems very, very strange. In China, it's not.
Is there any evidence, at least evidence that the outside world might respect, supporting China's claims that this man is corrupt and was carrying out bribery?
There's just simply no way to assess any evidence which has been levelled against Meng Hongwei, because we don't know exactly what he's been charged with, where he's being held at the moment. Quite interestingly, the Ministry of Public Security issued a statement about Meng Hongwei on Monday, in which they explained they were holding him. And it was quite a confusing statement, but in there they said that the decision to investigate him was wise, correct, and timely. The kind of language which suggests they've already made up their minds on whether he's guilty or innocent.
And what could happen to him? I mean, will there likely be a trial? Is that part of the usual process there?
Well, there will be likely a trial, but a trial usually comes after the Communist Party, the ruling Communist Party, conducts its investigation. And in my experience, long years of covering China, it's very rare that somebody's accused of something and then is not found guilty at the end of that process. My best guess is that the next we'll hear about him is when he's been in court and found guilty of a crime and perhaps admitted to it, and we've got a sentence. The length of the sentence will depend on exactly the nature nature of the crime, of which we have no way of gauging at the moment.
Michael, there were concerns that Meng would make Interpol an extension of the Chinese state, helping it to arrest and extradite people. Is there any evidence that he did that?
That was a criticism, and that was a concern when he first took over the role as president of Interpol in 2016. But no, that really hasn't happened. Strangely, what has happened is that it shone a light on China's legal system by his detention. I mean, we're talking about an extraordinary situation in which on Sunday, Interpol announced that the president of the organization had resigned, and that's all they said. He was a missing person. They've just accepted this resignation from China. They haven't explained if it came from him, if it was came from his superiors, if it came from the Communist Party. It seems an extremely strange situation, all told.
The BBC's Michael Bristow in London. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for that.
The conflict in Yemen is taking a terrible toll on civilians who are caught in the crossfire. A civil war started there in 2014. Today in Yemen, much like in Syria, the fighting has turned into a proxy war involving other countries on opposite sides. The U.S. backs a coalition led by Saudi Arabia. It's trying to oust rebels known as Houthis. The Houthis are backed by Iran. David Miliband has seen all of this up close. He's president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. David Miliband, you were just in Yemen 2 weeks ago. What did you see there?
I mean, Yemen is the world's largest humanitarian crisis. This is a country of 28 million people. 8 million people are being fed by the UN World Food Programme every day. It's a country where 3.5 million people are on the brink of famine and where 83% of the population are in extreme poverty. And the temptation is to describe this as a tragedy. In fact, it's an indictment, because this is not a natural catastrophe. It's a man-made trauma that is the result of a war that has been waged over the last 3.5 years with neither side winning.
And I want to ask you about that war, because there are lots of people who want to pay attention to what's happening in Yemen. It feels very remote. It's very complicated as well. Could you describe in your own words what this is all about?
Yeah. I mean, Yemen's conflict goes to the heart of the trauma that is going across the Middle East at the moment. The government of Yemen was toppled in 2014 by a Houthi coup. The Houthis are a group from the north of the country, socioeconomically deprived. They rolled over the then government and captured 70% of the country. And what's happened since then is that a Saudi-led coalition with US support, also UK, other European support, so it's not that far from home because the US is very strongly implicated in this, a Saudi-led coalition has been trying to topple the Yemeni control of the capital, Sana'a, and of 70% of the country. The truth is that 18,000 bombing raids that have been led by the Saudi-led coalition have not shifted the front lines. 70 to 80% of the humanitarian and commercial traffic goes through the port of Hodeidah, which is currently choked, really, by the fighting. Only a trickle of aid and commercial traffic is getting through. And what's happening in Yemen is that that conflict between the Houthis and the Saudi-led coalition has brought in the Iranians, who are supporting the Houthis.
But in other words, they're on the other side from the Saudis, the US, and the UK.
Exactly. So immediately you have a theological split, Sunni versus Shia. You also have a split of intra-regional power struggle. But in the chaos, other groups are emerging, separatist groups in the south, Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula in the east, ISIS growing as well. And the case that I saw with my own eyes is that this is a humanitarian catastrophe. The levels of malnutrition are absolutely shocking in that country. There are children literally starving to death. But at the same time, there is a political emergency too, because the only side that is gaining from the current stalemate are the extremists of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And it's a country now which is on the verge of meltdown, not just humanitarian meltdown, but political meltdown.
And what does that mean?
It means that the humanitarian meltdown is that 3.5 million people are on the verge of famine. 40,000 children are waiting for hospital places in Yemen. There isn't the fuel to support the hospitals. There isn't the fuel for the cars. You can see half-a-mile queues at gas stations on the road. You've got teachers and doctors and nurses who are not being paid because public sector salaries are not being paid. It's a country which can't sustain itself at the moment. It's being ravaged by a war that is not to the benefit of any of the sides who are waging it, but is in fact being exploited by extremists. And I think that the onus on the permanent members of the Security Council, including the US and the UK, is to recognise that this crisis is to no one's benefit. The war is not being won. And the only way to address both the humanitarian and the political emergency is a ceasefire. When in a hole, stop digging. And that's the message that needs to go to the Saudi-led coalition.
So hold on right there for a second. What is it that the Saudis, the UK, the US, and the others want? What's their goal?
Their goal is, first of all, to roll back Houthi influence, which they see as being allied to the Iranians. Secondly, to reestablish what they call the legitimate government that was in place before the 2014 coup. And thirdly, and importantly for Saudi Arabia, they want to be secure from missiles being sent from Yemen into Saudi Arabia. And there's no question that the Houthis have launched missiles into Saudi Arabia, so there are legitimate security concerns. But what I saw was that the price being paid by the Yemeni people far outweighed the costs that were being imposed on the other side.
We should say that U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the coalition is taking steps to minimize civilian casualties.
And that obviously sticks in the gullet, because I met Yemenis who told me about missiles that had landed on a hospital next to a healthcare center that we were delivering. And they all know about the fact that the Saudis bombed a coach of school children, more than 40 of them killed, in August. The Secretary of State, the U.S. Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has indeed certified, as he's required to by congressional legislation, that everything is being done to protect civilians.
But we know
that 7,500 civilians have been directly killed, never mind the indirect effects on far larger numbers.
And why would the U.S. not want to protect civilians? Why would the U.K. and even Saudi Arabia? I mean, why would that not be a priority?
I'm not casting any ad hominem judgment. What I'm saying is that the fact is that civilians are not being protected. And the conduct of the war has breached the most basic norms of international humanitarian law, both on the Saudi-led coalition side and on the Houthi side. Independent UN inquiries have produced extensive documentation of terrible breaches of international humanitarian law, in other words, the targeting of civilians by both sides. And this is a crisis that now I came away saying that the world needs to wake up to what's going on in Yemen. And the tragedy is, at the UN General Assembly, there was no all-night session of the UN Security Council on Yemen. The UK holds the pen on the Yemen file, but the pen needs to be picked up, because there is not a current debate to replace the failed UN Security Council resolution of 2015 with something that is actually a route map to peace rather than a carte blanche for war.
If we take the issue of refugees, which obviously the IRC focuses on, to the U.S. and directly to Washington, you have said that regarding help from the Western world, that you've moved from a relatively benign climate to a relatively hostile one. We know the Trump administration has cut by 75% the number of refugees it admits into this country every year. How does that affect your work?
Well, just for the benefit of your listeners, there are about 28 million refugees and asylum seekers around the world today. Most of them are in poor countries, not rich countries. Countries like Jordan and Lebanon, countries like Kenya, Ethiopia, Uganda, countries like Bangladesh. Historically, for the most vulnerable refugees, widows, victims of torture, or orphaned children, the US has stepped up and been a leader in what's called refugee resettlement, which means bringing, on average, about 90,000 refugees a year to the US. Actually, under the Reagan administration, it was over 200,000. And those people go on to become productive members of American society. The Trump administration has, first of all, changed the security vetting arrangements. They wanted to update them. That's legitimate for any government to do. But they've also reduced by 75% the cap on the number of refugees who are allowed into the U.S. And that obviously means that individual lives are affected. There are 50,000 Iraqis who've supported the work of the U.S. military and government in Iraq, translators and things. They're not being allowed into the country either. So there are individual stories of people who fear for their own lives, who can't now start a new life
in the U.S. Who worked on behalf of the U.S., which is part of the reason they're in trouble.
Exactly. They're being targeted because of their support for the U.S. They're not being allowed in either. So you've got this clampdown on refugees who are fleeing for their lives, clamp down on people who would claim refugee status because of their work for the US government. And the great danger is that a bipartisan program of proven success, remember, refugees contribute more to the American economy than they take out in welfare payments, a proven program is being strangled. And this year, we are having to deal with the fact that there was a historic low in the number of refugees allowed in, only 21,000 in the fiscal year that ended on September the 30th. The Trump administration has set a ceiling of 30,000 for this fiscal year, which started on October the 1st. And so what we see is not just the effect on individual lives of those who would have come here. There's also the fact that countries around the world are seeing that the US doesn't have their back. Let me give you an example. Jordan, the second closest ally of the United States in the Middle East, it's dealing with 650,000 registered refugees from Syria. It's dependent on support from the outside world, but it also wants countries like America to stand with it. It wants to be able to say to its own people, look, America's standing with us in dealing with this Syrian refugee crisis, so we've got to continue to stand up ourselves. The King of Jordan says his country's at breaking point. And so since we operate both as a refugee resettlement agency here, but also an international humanitarian aid agency in countries like Jordan and Lebanon, we can see the impact on American influence and the American reputation.
So just put a finer point on that. You're saying that you can see the impact on the ground in a place like Jordan, an American ally, of the Trump administration reducing by 75% the number of refugees who can come to this country.
Yes, because you know that the number of Syrians who were allowed in last fiscal year was only around 40. And that is felt as a poke in the eye by countries that are hosting very large numbers of refugees. No one's saying a large proportion of the 28 million refugees and asylum seekers should be coming to the US, but that show of standing in solidarity with countries that are hosting refugees so that the most vulnerable get a chance to start a new life is something that's been a core part of the American foreign policy tradition for a long time. And it would be a real tragedy if it was to be lost completely.
David Miliband, thank you.
Thank you.
David Miliband is president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The People's Bank of China announced yesterday that it'll reduce the amount of reserves commercial banks are required to hold by 1 percentage point. The move frees up banks to lend up to $175 billion to Chinese borrowers. This is seen as China's latest attempt to spur growth in the face of biting tariffs from the Trump administration. Some analysts have characterized those tariffs as impulsive, but there are now some people who think they may be a part of a grand U.S. strategy toward China. We're going to talk about that now with Jill Schlesinger. She's business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hello, Jill.
Hello.
So first, two telling stats. Stocks in Shanghai have fallen 15% since the beginning of this year, and China's currency has weakened 9% against the U.S. dollar. So there are signs that the Chinese economy is indeed vulnerable. The Chinese Communist Party derives its legitimacy from continuing economic growth. So how much is that growth and that legitimacy in jeopardy now?
Well, look, the Chinese economy, which is a $12 trillion economy, the second largest in the world, is still going to grow this year, probably by around, let's call it 6.5% or so. But a lot of the problems that the country has faced predate the Trump administration's tariffs. We know that the manufacturing sector has certainly been hit recently, but, you know, we've seen the pace of expansion of investment in houses and factories and railroads, key driver of Chinese growth, has actually fallen. And that was happening before the tariffs. What we're seeing in this action by the government is an attempt to spur economic growth, but also to kind of make sure that everyone knows they still have a little gunpowder left and that the Chinese economy is not going to sputter out of control without the government being involved.
It seems as though the Trump administration's goal is to weaken China as much as it can. But I wonder how different things are from the Obama era. The current White House uses a lot more bellicose language, whereas back then Barack Obama called U.S.-China strategy a pivot. At the core, though, isn't the goal continuing to try to stop China's rise?
I don't know if it's to stop the rise. I do think that both administrations share one core belief, and that is that, you know, they want China to actually continue modernizing its economy, but they are not so clear that they like these business and trade practices, which essentially say to the United States and the companies based in the United States, come on, sell your goods here. You can operate, but you're going to have to cough up your technology or go into a joint venture with a Chinese company. So I don't think that we're trying to stop China. I think we're trying to make the Chinese trade practices fairer. And I think that has been consistent over the last dozen or so years.
And how effective is it?
Well, you know, right now we don't know. And I think that these trade tariffs have become really problematic in essence because they start sparking other conversations. We hear Chinese officials saying, hey, you know, you want to be really tough. You want to start putting more tariffs, another $257 billion of goods. Well, don't forget, we're the key to North Korea. So this isn't just a trade issue. It's a power issue. And it does appear that the Trump administration is trying to throw a wedge in there, getting allies on one side all lined up with new trade policies, and then forcing the allies to kind of come with the U.S. and freeze out China and try to really agitate for more reform. We don't know whether it's going to be successful or not, but it does seem to be a bit more strategic than initially thought.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Always nice to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thank you.
The largest unsolved art heist in history happened nearly 30 years ago in Boston, and it remains one of the art world's most confounding mysteries. $500 million worth of art were stolen from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in 1990. There were 13 pieces in all, including works by Rembrandt, Degas, Vermeer, and Manet. Since the heist, there have been no arrests, and not a piece of stolen art has been recovered. WBUR and the Boston Globe have launched a podcast called Last Seen to investigate how and why that's the case. Here are reporters Jack Rodolico and Kelly Horan.
In the early hours of March 18, 1990, the city of Boston was still celebrating St. Patrick's Day. Hangovers would be widespread come daybreak. So would news that the city's most unusual museum had been the victim of a daring overnight robbery.
Good evening, I'm Casey Kaufman, and here's what's happening. A priceless collection of artwork was stolen early this morning from Boston's Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum.
It was 1 a.m. Saturday that two men posing as uniformed policemen fooled security guards here by claiming to be investigating a disturbance.
Initial estimates put the value of the stolen works at least
$200 million.
$200 million.
The 87-year-old Gardner Museum is considered one of the finest small art museums in the country.
Officials say the museum's elaborate surveillance system made no difference.
Museum officials today said it was the largest art heist in history.
Despite the confidence of museum officials that the precious artworks will be recovered, experts say they could disappear for years, perhaps forever. Brad Willis, TV4, Eyewitness News.
The thieves who pulled off the greatest art heist in history had a pretty simple plan. They dressed up in cop uniforms and rang the bell. It was 1:24 in the morning, and the thieves approached the Palace Road entrance of the Gardner Museum. There'd been a keg party nearby. A few revelers were still on the streets. And when the fake cops told the museum guard on duty that they were responding to a disturbance, it seemed plausible. Maybe some drunk kid had gotten up to some mischief. After all, earlier in the evening, the guards' rounds had been interrupted by a fire alarm blaring from the museum's carriage house outside. It had really spooked him. Maybe that's why the cops had come, and so he buzzed them into the museum.
That guard was Rick Abbath.
They came in and they turned so I could see them. I could see that they had hats, coats, badges, and they looked like cops, so I buzzed them the rest of the way into the museum.
Steve Kirkchin and Rick Abbath talked about that night at an Indian restaurant in 2013.
The first question was, is anybody else here?
I see, right.
And I said, my partner, okay, get him down here.
This is the first time that former guard, the one who was on duty that night with Abbath, has ever spoken publicly about his experience.
Kept wondering if they might just come up behind my head with a gun with a silencer and just, you know, do it real quickly.
It was a terrifying night, and all these years later, he'd still rather we not use his full name. His first name, though, is Randy.
In 1990, Randy had a passion for symphonic music, the Moody Blues, and the trombone. He still plays, makes a living at it, mostly in house bands on cruise ships. But back then, Randy had recently earned a master's in performance from the New England Conservatory of Music. He was trying to land gigs and make ends meet.
But I always had to have some kind of a day job kind of thing to supplement the income, make sure the bills get paid and so forth.
Randy knew a couple of people who worked at the Gardner, and that's how he landed his security job there.
It wasn't something that required you to have any kind of special skills, you know. I remember being trained to, if any people were getting real close to a painting, and we were told to get them to stand back a little bit and don't get so close.
A few months into his job, Randy began filling in on the overnight shift. The pay was better, $11 an hour versus $7 or $8 for the daytime shift.
You know, at nighttime, when there are no visitors, when you're not doing a round, you can bring stuff to read. I could bring my horn and practice. I was always happy to say yes to filling in.
Randy doesn't recall any special training or specific instructions for the night shift beyond the requirement that he register his presence in each of the galleries on all the floors during his rounds. He did this by swiping a magnetic strip. He wasn't originally on the schedule to work the overnight after St. Patrick's Day. Randy was filling in for another guard who had reportedly called in sick. Abbath had told him about the carriage house alarm, but he hadn't thought much of it until he saw the two police officers talking to Abbath at the watch desk.
It never occurred to me that they might be anything but Boston police. I immediately made that connection. This might have something to do with that alarm that went off.
One of the uniformed men said he recognized Abbath and asked to see his ID.
He said, yeah, I do know you. There's a warrant out for your arrest. And he told Rick to stand against the wall, put his arms up. He does the pat down. He puts the cuffs on. And I'm just standing there with my jaw open, going, wow, you know, what's going on? What did Rick do? Is he really into some kind of trouble? And it still never occurred to me that they were anything but policemen.
By stepping out and away from the desk, Rick Abbath also stepped away from the sole means of signaling trouble to the outside world, the museum's panic button.
No sooner was Abbath against a wall and handcuffed than Randy was too.
I kept asking him over and over, why are we being arrested? Why are we being arrested? And he wouldn't answer. So the cuffs are on, my hands are behind my back, and then duct tape starts going on around my eyes. So about the time that he begins putting the duct tape on, he says, this is a robbery. And so then everything was finally crystal clear what was going on. You know, it was just really strange. None of it made any sense. And then suddenly it made a lot of sense.
I mean, it's scary enough to think you're being arrested and not know why. What was going through your mind when suddenly duct tape is going around your head?
It's very scary. And I'm worried for my life. But they were immediately saying, I can remember both of them saying, you know, follow instructions and you will not get hurt. So that gave me some relief. And I just felt like, okay, don't try anything stupid. Don't try anything stupid. Go along with whatever there's nothing here in this museum that is worth my life.
The thieves wound duct tape around Randy and Abbath's heads from chin to scalp, across their eyes and across their mouths, with only a slit so they could breathe. Then, stair by stair, the robbers led the guards, who couldn't see a thing, down to the basement. One of the thieves used another pair of handcuffs to attach Randy to a drainpipe under a limestone sink near a boiler. Randy recalls that that thief was the calmer of the two, and weirdly courteous.
The guy who cuffed me, he was making sure that they weren't too tight on my wrist, and he adjusted it several times, and he said, "You're going to be here for a long time, so I don't want these to be too tight." So he was real calm and real nice about it, and he also several times said, "Sorry to have to do this."
Randy just wanted the guy to get away from him, to go do what he had come to do, and to get out of there.
Were you panicking?
It was scary, and I remember feeling like I needed to prepare myself for death if it ended up coming to that.
What did that mean, preparing yourself for death?
Well, I was running music through my head a lot, just feeling like I don't know what happens to us when we die. It's all a mystery, but I just felt like I needed to be mentally prepared.
Was there a particular piece of music that you ran through your mind?
Definitely, I remember one of the pieces, the Mozart Requiem. It didn't occur to me later that that has to do with dead people.
Randy spent the next 8 hours shackled on the basement floor, terrified the entire time that the thieves would return to kill him.
Reporters Jack Rodolico and Kelly Horan in an excerpt from Last Scene, a new podcast from the Boston Globe and WBUR. It investigates the largest unsolved art heist in history, the theft of 13 pieces of art from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. Last Scene is available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Norman Lear has been a keen observer of American life and attitudes about as long as anyone. He's 96 years old. More than 45 years ago, he created some of the most iconic sitcoms in American TV history. All in the Family, The Jeffersons, One Day at a Time, and Maude. At one time, he had 9 programs on the air. They were funny, and they were powerful. Take All in the Family.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made the hit parade.
The man of the house was Archie Bunker. He liked his easy chair at his home in Queens. He liked his cigar and white people. He didn't like blacks, or Japs as he called them, and certainly not gay people. So he wasn't happy when his son-in-law Mike once invited a friend over to the house for lunch.
Just because a guy is sensitive and he's an intellectual and he wears glasses, you make him out a queer.
I never said a guy who wears glasses is a queer. A guy who wears glasses is a four-eyes. A guy who is a fag is a queer.
Norman Lear navigated the tough terrain of making Americans laugh at the show and squirm at the same time. The programs dealt with Americans' divided attitudes about race and religion, gender, immigration, and war. We spoke to him in Boston last week. He said the caustic conversations in his shows were inspired by the typical talk at home when he was growing up.
Oh, yeah. My family lived at the end of their nerves and the top of their lungs about anything. What? Gert is coming? She didn't come to the wedding 22 years ago, and now she's coming? That was my life. Oh, and that could have been something heavily political also, but it was largely in the small fish area.
When you dealt so openly through Archie Bunker and All in the Family with racism, I mean, there's racist utterances coming from him in every program. Obviously, you trusted that the audience would get that, that the audience would react appropriately?
I had no doubt the audience would get that.
Why? How did you know that? That was a very volatile time.
Because what you could hear in the schoolyard was every bit as rough or tough or unusual daily. And what we did was no tougher, rougher, or less ordinary than that, or more ordinary.
One of the issues that is consuming many Americans right now is the issue of sexual assault, and not just because of the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, but also because of the Me Too movement. You tackled this head-on quite strikingly, you and the writers for All in the Family. There was an episode in, I think it was 1973, where the daughter in All in the Family, played by Sally Struthers, was assaulted.
I was so frightened, you see, and, well, he dragged me behind the wood there, and he put a scarf or something in my mouth so that I couldn't scream, and then I felt my clothes tearing and his hands on me, and then I passed out, and when I came to, he was gone.
That's all right, that's all right, that's all
then
right.
In another episode later, a lengthy episode, Jean Stapleton herself was assaulted in their home, in the family home.
That really, I haven't thought about this, connects with what is going on today. We had the episode in which she was, the attempted rape took place and her escape from it and everything else. The audience went wild at the finish of that show.
The reaction was so strong, Lear told us, that he and his show's producers felt compelled to do a follow-up program.
The reactions of others, especially males, to a woman who'd been in that situation, it was like they felt she was dirty. Archie had to get over feeling that his wife had been with another man.
You dealt with it with a scene where Archie at one point hugs Edith to say, things are okay. I love you. I respect you still. That was a live audience that was responding, which was a first for the time. But you, the writers, mixed some comedic lines in there, like the person who is assaulting Edith says, "You smell good," and she says, "It's lemon pledge." I mean, it's a comedy show, so that's why there's comedy in there. But how did that help what you were doing when you were conveying such a...
I think it made it more human. I've never seen a moment, I've never lived a moment where I didn't see humor. You know, I remember standing at a gravesite and the woman, the wife of the body going down, evidently had to scratch her ass. And she did. And I'm standing behind and I see this. And how do you not smile? How do you not understand human nature is such, life is such, there's a laugh to be found anywhere.
Do you think the meaning's greater because people are laughing 1 minute and horrified the next when they watch episodes like those?
I think laughter helps. I'm confident that laughter has added time to my life.
Norman Lear, thank you.
Esther Margolis, thank you.
It's Lisa Mullins, close enough. 96-year-old writer-producer Norman Lear. He was in Boston where he was honored last week by the school he attended, Emerson College. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now.